Before we begin, Simran and I want to acknowledge that we're recording this from First Nations country. I'm recording this from my house on Bunurong country, and Simran is recording this from her house on Yugambeh country. We'd like to acknowledge and pay respects to First Nations elders past and present, and extend that respect to First Nations listeners.
Always was, always will be Aboriginal land. Welcome back to Boldly Relevant.
My name's Ryan.
And I'm Simran.
And this is the podcast for burnt out girlies trying to stay
Boldly Relevant. Hey, we're back. Oh my goodness. We are recording from two different places, which is a bit crazy. I feel a little bit of separation anxiety.
Yeah.
Mostly because I had to do all of my technical troubleshooting by myself, and I'm too pretty for that, okay? Never again shall this happen.
I want like a cute little matcha with you, but I can't do that, so.
I know, so sad. Yeah, look, yeah. I'm in the Gold Coast right now because I was having a mental breakdown and wanted to come back home and see my parental, so that's what I did.
Broadly News.
So the big piece of news that's going around town is these two women that want to share the role of MP, which is such an interesting story. So Lucy Bradlow and Bronwyn Bock, they're lifelong friends from Melbourne. Oh my god, they're just like us. Launched their campaign over the weekend, jointly running as the independent candidate for the electorate of Higgins in 2020. So basically they're saying that they'll share this role, and their whole thing is that they'll produce like better outcomes for the constituents because they'll get two perspectives for the price of one. And it really is going to be for the price of one, because they're going to be sharing the same salary. And how it'll work is they'll go 1 week in and 1 week off. And when you vote, like for certain things in parliament, it'll still count. Just the one word. Interesting. And technically, there's actually no legal like issue about it in the constitution. The only issue that they're running into is that they can't put two names in the ballot application form, basically, because it's not big enough, and so they have to like petition basically for that to be extended so that they can fit both names in there, which is so funny. But like, love that for them. Would you like your job like to be split, like a two-person split with a person?
Absolutely. I love tag teaming.
Oh, really?
Like, it's so much work doing everything yourself. Yeah. And, like, you get to, like, share insights, have someone to debrief with. Like, absolutely. And also, that's the sort of innovation that our parliamentary system needs, you know?
Yeah, that's very true. And it's like, they'll really, like, up that diversity quota so quickly, though, you know what I mean?
With two white women.
Yeah, absolutely. God, we can't wish for it all here, can we? Did you really like group projects in, like, uni and school? Did you like them?
So I hated group projects in uni.
Yeah.
Specifically my business degree, because you'd be paired with just, like, people who don't care.
Right. About a business degree? What? Can it be?
Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy.
Or more likely, I didn't care, and totally. They were like, the stocks, and I'd be like, what about human rights?
Wow. Preach, you ally.
But yeah, I unfortunately love group projects in rest of my life.
Oh, true. Yeah, no, yeah. I'm too much of a control freak, to be honest. Like, I think, and I've also come to realize I don't like groups in general. I like 3 to 4, right? I like 3 to 4 people in a group. That's like my ideal. I don't even like friendship groups. Like, the concept, not my vibe. I don't like it.
You just want a diversity of individual friends.
Absolutely. And famously, I hate friendship groups, all right?
Is that why you were never in one?
Okay, slap me in the face, why don't you? Neither of you.
Yeah, so in other news, the comedy festival obviously ended on the weekend. And at one of the final shows from Arish Barker, who is like a successful comedian, I surmise. I have never seen him, but I've heard the name. He kicked out a breastfeeding mom for having a baby there.
That's wild.
Important to note, the baby actually wasn't disturbing anyone.
Oh.
He was getting distracted.
Oh, so he's just a man, is what I'm hearing. Wow. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so he's the worst. Got it.
And then the funniest part is that the mom who was apparently humiliated by it, then spent all of yesterday going on all the talk shows.
With her baby. With her baby. Okay, so the worst part was she went on the project, right? And she was with her baby doing the interview. And I think it's valid to be, like, upset about that. She was just, like, breastfeeding her child, whatever. If it wasn't, like, kicking up a fuss, it wasn't kicking up a fuss. However, you know, babies can't always not kick up a fuss. And that baby was not happy on the project. And then one of the project hosts was like, oh, do you want to hand it back to dad? And after she, like, spent the time defending him. But I was like, babe, you just have to, like, let that one ride out or, like, cut the interview short in a natural way. But that's pretty horrible. I saw Aurelia St. Clair on her story saying, like, this news kind of, it makes sense why more and more women are, like, choosing, like, not to have kids, because this is, like, kind of like the rhetoric that they get back, like, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
Yeah. And look, so I'm reading here, actually, apparently it was a little more than a little bit of gurgling from the baby. Right, there's this quote from this Guardian article where it's like, they're talking about the baby crying and how Arj got distracted. He was trying to tell a joke and he asked, like, if the baby could leave. And it's just like, I so hear the note. But as a performer, suck it up.
Yeah, like, push through.
If a baby is throwing you, perhaps don't get on stage.
No, totally. Perhaps showbiz is not for you, okay?
Maybe go to a film set or something. Like, it just irks me because it's like, you know, the nature of performance is that it's unpredictable and unreliable.
Yeah.
Embrace it. And also, let's be a little bit more inclusive and let new mothers to come to the theater. Like, come, you know?
No, totally. And all roads lead back to JoJo Siwa on this one, because, and let me tell you why, all right? So Abby Lee Miller is the creator of the show Dance Moms, and I remember her, like, saying, me watching when I was, like, 13 years old, that, you know, you never run off stage, you never give in to, like, what the audience is doing, you keep going with your performance, or you're not made for showbiz, honey, and I've taken that in my life very seriously, all right? I don't care if they're booing. You have to stay on stage. It doesn't matter. Moving on to more man news. That's how I'm going to frame it. That's my segue. That's what I'm sticking with.
Go on, what did we do? Yeah.
So the Australian men's Olympic football team have failed to qualify for the 2024 Paris Olympics. Also, I don't know why I didn't know this, but their name is the Olyroos, which is just terrible.
Oh, Olyroos. Because
Olympics and, like, kangaroos. Olyroos.
It's a stupid name.
It's the worst name ever. But basically, the team were eliminated from the Asian Cup, which was also the men's football qualifier for this year's Olympics, because they did not score a goal in their three Asian Cup matches against Jordan, Qatar, and Indonesia. That is so embarrassing. Sorry.
Wait, I thought they were called the Suckers.
Yeah, oh, I guess because, so it says in men's Olympics football, the majority of the team players must be under the age of 23, and only three players can be older. So this is why the Australian men's Olympic team is the Olyroos. They're not the Socceroos. And actually, the rule doesn't apply to women's Olympic football, which is so interesting.
That's wild.
Yeah.
So the Matildas are going, right?
Yeah, the Matildas are going.
Yeah, okay, fine.
They secured their spot in February. Yeah, they were like, we've been doing this. Yeah.
Good news, nothing to say.
Yeah, good news. And that's fine, honestly.
Yeah, well, fuck the Olyroos, fuck the Socceroos.
Oh, okay, sure. Totally.
What? Is that not the takeaway?
I don't know if that's the takeaway. I think it's just kind of, like, funny.
Well, A, they're not interesting. B, they can't even get into the Olympics. Boring.
Boring!
Broadly Culture.
So TTPD came out.
Yes, it sure did.
Boring ass album from Miss Taylor Swift.
Oh, okay, straight into it, are we? Straight into it.
Well, no, I will, because it's like, it came out, and then I was like, let me listen to it. I'll even read the lyrics, because my auditory processing disorder makes it hard to understand them. And yeah, you know, she had some, like, harsh critiques of people, but it's like, I'm going to be honest, Taylor Allison Swift, as a music listener with an auditory processing disorder, I actually don't care about your lyricism. Give me good music.
That is so tea. Oh my goodness. That's surprising because I feel like Taylor Swift, the point of her is her lyricism, no? But that's hard. And I see you, and you deserve to listen to Taylor's music also.
That's why the day that TTPD came out, I listened to 5 songs, and then I put on Cowboy Corner.
Yeah. No, and that's the thing. And I messaged Ryan being like, I'm trying so hard to listen to this, but all I want to listen to is Chapel Roan, okay? I'm trying so hard to listen to TTPD, but all I want to listen to is Chapel Roan. Don't blame me.
And here's the annoying thing, right? Every time I open my music app to go and listen to some music, I'm like, I want to listen to some bangers. And I scroll down through all the recently added songs. No bangers, right?
No bangers.
Cowboy Carter, nice. It has Texas Hold'em, but like a limit to the bangers. But it's like the most banger song to have come out recently is Chapel Roan.
Yeah, and thank God for it, honestly. There is a New York Times article called On the Tortured Poets Department, Taylor Swift Could Use an Editor. And I totally agree with that. It was like gotten a lot of backlash for this article, but essentially, like, she's kind of saying a lot of the same things, and like the songs kind of all meld into one another. I know that a lot of people are saying that the more you listen to it, the better it gets, and I don't like deny that or anything because I've only listened to it once, but all this music kind of sound the same, and it's upsetting because, you know, there's only so many chord progressions, and that's not her fault, but I don't know. It's giving nothing. And like the thank you, Amy stuff is like the only thing that's like kind of keeping me interested. But I don't know. It's just like not the vibe. But I think as like we've evolved a little bit and like part of our audience has evolved as well, like we kind of expect maybe a little more emotional evolution for her as well. You know, it feels just like a little too raw, a little, and that sounds so bad because like everybody should have their own feelings and like everybody, you know, should feel valid in like whatever emotion comes up. And like, this is like her healing process, you know, but it's like so many albums on and it's kind of like the same thing. You know, like the same stance, and like not to say that like you need to like reinvent yourself like every 2 seconds, but it's like also just like as a fan perspective kind of concerning that like the emotional maturity hasn't changed, I guess, in the songs that she is writing. It would be the same as like my friend was like, you know, kept doing this and like kept, you know, talking about like things that have like wronged her, like, or like like things that she like struggles with, like in the same way as she would have talked about it like if she was in high school, you know. Yeah, that's my take. Thoughts, feelings, emotions?
No, absolutely. And I feel like, you know, when she announced it at the Grammys or whatever, she was like, I needed to write this, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you did 100% you did, Miss Swift. You perhaps also could have used a diary.
Yeah. And it feels a little misogynistic, like, when we're saying this. I just think that she's, like, maybe a better artist than this, though.
100%. And I don't think she's, like, claiming that it's necessarily artistic genius, because it's definitely not.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, like, it's an incredibly personal track, but it doesn't feel personal in, like, a reflective and somber way. It's just, like, look, here it is. Like, it feels like a first draft.
Yeah, it does feel like a first draft. I would love to see the second draft.
Yeah, it's also just, but I don't know, it's not the energy I want to be carrying into my Melbourne winter, you know? I'm like, give me renaissance.
Yeah.
Give me renaissance.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, again, recession call. Everybody needs to give us bops only. Sorry.
You know, please do not be alarmed. The DJ will be troubleshooting.
No,
you know?
Totally. So in other news of culture, I don't know if you've heard of the YouTube channel called Watcher, but it's essentially made up of former BuzzFeed workers, Ryan Bergara, Stephen Lim, and Shane Madge. And they used to like upload. Why did I say it like that? They have like series called like Ghost Files, Mystery Files, and Puppet History. Yeah.
Oh, I've watched the ghost ones.
Yeah, that's all them. And they've basically made this like production company. You know, they get like millions of views per video, which is great. Here's where it kind of goes wrong. Earlier this week, they said that the content studio will be taking new episodes of like these series onto its new standalone and paywalled platforms where fans would have to pay $6 a month or $60 a year to watch. And they were like, okay, this is like affordable, and so like you should be able to do this, basically. They say it's low enough where everybody and anybody is able to afford it. Fans did not think so. They lost more than 50,000 subscribers in 24 hours and nearly,
fuck.
Yeah, and then like nearly 100,000 like over the weekend, basically. So yeah, people were not happy at all. And then the Watcher basically rolled back their decision and came out with another video saying that they overlooked the way it would impact all of the viewers. They still will introduce its own streaming service at the same price, but future like Watcher content will not be like exclusive to that streaming service. So basically it'll like post on that streaming service, and then a month later the same content will go out on YouTube. So it's kind of like their own Patreon sort of thing. Yeah. Like you kind of get like the content earlier than other people. And actually Watcher is giving all of its current patrons over on Patreon, which is like more than 13,000 people paying at least like $5 a month, a free membership to the service. And it says that it'll refund any patron who's already paid to subscribe. Mm. Yeah, very interesting. So they said, like, we're sorry for how we originally delivered our goodbye message to YouTube. It was, like, a very dramatic video. And they said, like, it was insensitive. We didn't really express how much we appreciate all of you, and you did a really bad job of explaining the reasoning behind this transition. And their reason was basically that they are finding it harder and harder to stay relevant to advertisers on YouTube in the constantly changing YouTube landscape. So basically, it's, like, financial issues.
Yes.
Which I can understand, you know, like you're trying to like pivot in a way, but very like interesting thoughts and like conversations coming out of this whole situation about the concept of paying for content, you know?
Well, it's such a messy, messy thing. Yeah. You know, and like I feel like actually YouTube creators have it the easiest because YouTube has that really, you know, like you might not have done this, but YouTube creators get a proportion of the ad revenue from ads shown in their videos. Mm-hmm. Whereas like on TikTok and Instagram, creators don't have that stability. There might be like one-off bonuses or programs, but those platforms haven't been sustainable like that, you know? And then it's like, that's why everyone's turning to like Patreon and stuff. Instagram has their Instagram subscriptions. Have you seen those?
No, I haven't. I didn't realize you could subscribe on Instagram.
Yeah, so you can subscribe to people on Insta and, like, pay them, like, $1 a month, $2 a month for, like, exclusive content.
True. Which
is really interesting. And I'm like, if that caught on, like, that would kill, wouldn't kill OnlyFans, but it would kill, like, the people who don't put nudes on OnlyFans.
Yeah.
Because you get to, like, have it all in one place, which is really interesting. But, yeah, I don't blame them for trying to do that because, like, so fair. But it sounds like it was mishandled.
I think it was mishandled. And I think this is a good compromise that they've come to, actually. It, like, makes sense for them. And it also means that, like, I think a lot of creators these days, like, including myself, like, as a, you know, as a journalist, yeah, I'll talk as about it again. Okay. But, like, the content that you create, it's very scary to, like, post it and, like, essentially give it to these platforms that you have no say on whatsoever. So I understand like the concept of wanting to own their own content like fully, even off of Patreon, because this is like essentially this like the same thing. But yeah, it's a hard one. So part of me is like, I think that part of me is like, you should be paying artists and you should be paying like creators for their work, right? And then the other part of me, the broke part of me, is like, I think we should also be able to access like art and content for free. So it's like a very like hard line to like figure out on. But I think it was just mishandled in the way that they said it to fans, because at the end of the day, none of these creators would be anything without the fans and without the followers. Yeah, it's a hard one.
Well, okay, but yes, creators should be paid. Because of the way the internet is going, like everyone expects ads to pay for that. But then, especially with these platforms, they're taking the majority of the ad revenue, right? Meta manages to generate €6 per user per month based off showing you ads, which is actually quite a lot of money.
Again, not a fact-checking podcast, so like, Google that if you want. I don't know.
And then it's like, you know, it's contributing to like all this massive growth in the tech industry, but like doesn't get paid out to the creators, except on YouTube a little bit, but it's like also hard to monetize there. So yeah, you know, it's a brave new world where we do expect people to pay for content, but you know, at the same time, it's going to take some adjusting.
And that's the tea.
Broadly deep.
Do you remember high school, Simran?
Oh, do I? actually, not a lot. Seemed to. Trauma blocked that out.
I did not. I was having the best time of my life.
Totally. So Ryan and I, if you don't know, if you're new to the podcast, Ryan and I met in school. And at our school, they did the IB program. It's the International Baccalaureate. It's a really... It's actually one that's so pretentious, and it is. It is one of the most prestigious programs that you can go through, but it is also one of the hardest programs that you can go to.
Yes.
It essentially equips people to be more self-sufficient and like self-learning. Like that's like their whole ethos. They want you to give high school students a taste of what it would be like in the real world. Specifically, the real world that they're referring to is like university, and that like self-learning.
The real world of university.
That self-learning principles that you kind of have to like carry through your uni career. I think that Ryan and I kind of see things a little differently, like on the Ivy well, but there are whole Reddit threads like dedicated to the trauma that Ivy,
which I've been sending you today.
Yeah, no, totally. I haven't opened a single one.
No, I've seen. I've got red receipts.
Okay, totally. What? How did you feel about your IB career? Pros, cons.
Look, I feel like I knew very early on that I wanted to study theater, which, let's be honest, theater, while I see it as an academic discipline, is not necessarily an academic discipline when it comes to university admissions.
Totally.
So I did not give a fucking shit about my marks at all, which meant I was just there to hang out and vibe and have fun and, you know, learn for the sake of learning. So I had a great time.
Right. So I have Indian parents, right? So that's not a thing. Okay, you learn to get a good job. Yeah, look, IB, I think pros were actually great at fostering critical thinking skills. You had a class literally called The Theory of Knowledge. So wanky. One of my like favorite classes that we ever did.
No, and it was wild because like there was so much that IB taught and instilled in us, and then I got to uni, and like we're learning how to make bibliographies, and I'm like, what?
Yeah, no, it was simply wild.
Because it actually, you know, I think set us ahead. But then it's not like you get to, it's not like in uni you can skip a unit. I still had to learn how to make a bibliography. I still had to sit through the how to do group work, you know, classes. Yeah. Like I was ahead, but for what, you know?
Literally for what?
So IB is year 1 to year 12 educational program split into the primary years program, the middle years program, and the diploma program. I actually did all three programs.
He's better than me. I did two of them.
And everything kind of scaffolds, and it's I think more than any other curriculum really focused on like you as a well-balanced individual.
Yeah, it's a holistic approach, and it's like an alternative to like your A levels or your ATAR.
Yeah, so it's like looking at like you know, like a fundamental part of it is us doing community and service, us doing an extended essay on just something that interests us. So it's like encouraging self inquisitiveness and like being curious about the world around us, and then teaching us the skills to do that research.
You also
very concerned with like the way you think and the way you learn and what sort of person you're becoming. Like there was the middle years, the learner profile. Do you remember the learner profile?
You have to be like a risk taker.
and mindful and principled, which fucking drilled into my brain. Absolutely. I'm like, yeah, I'm a risk taker. Yeah. I'm principled, which I really enjoyed that it wasn't focused on, you know, just cranking out people who can do STEM.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Like, a thing that I really liked about the DP, you know, all our friends not doing IB, they were off, like, you know, like, hyper-focusing on, like, chemistry or science or med. And whereas the diploma program forced you to do one unit, one subject from every sort of, like, field. So you had to do, like, an art, you had to do a science, you had to do, like, a technology, you had to do a language, you had to do a math, you had to do liberal art sort of course. And so it teaches you that breadth, you know, like, sure, people were doing, you know, complex math, but they also still had to analyze poetry. And I enjoyed that.
No, totally. And I can definitely see where you're coming from. I agree. I think in theory, like, the concept of it is, like, a really great concept in, like, pushing out people, like, and students that are well-rounded, really engaged, like, with critical thinking on any topic. Yeah. It's kind of similar to the American university system in the way that you have to, like, go through different areas and, like, see, you know, like, a more well-rounded approach before you go into, like, your one major. And for in that sense, I think that's, like, really smart. Where it got me was I think the amount of work that is expected and the amount of, like, self-led study expected for a 17-year-old, a 16-year-old is insane, actually. Because it's such a hard jump. And unless you're, like, doing the extended essay that Ryan was talking about is essentially a mini thesis that you have to figure out. A 16-year-old doesn't know shit. Like,
okay, mini thesis. It was 4,000 words. And, like, I understand that that felt 6, like 000. A lot because it was 4,000. It was definitely 4.
No. Let me look at
But, I totally get where you're coming from. And it was a jump from what we'd been doing prior. But, like, we all managed to do it.
Didn't we? Yeah, okay. We all managed to do it, but not all of us managed to be the same persons that we started off with.
I think you're right that the course was misadministered in our context.
Okay,
but I think the actual curriculum expects a lot from its students, but, like, I think you can expect a lot from children.
I think you should. I think that the amount of work that we had to do should have been spread out in 3 years as opposed to 2 years. Or, like, 2.5 years than 3 years, you know?
I'll agree with that.
Like,
I'll
we
agree.
Were reading... So the OP kids, because it was split, you could do OP or IB at our school. It was a very...
OP is the former Queensland curriculum.
Yes. And there was a very small cohort of us that were doing IB. I think, like, 17 of us, was it? 14?
14 or something.
14 to 17. I think it was definitely 14. Yeah. We had to, in just, like, our English literature class, all of us, like, kind of took, like, high-level literature. We had to read 4 books each semester, as opposed to the OP kids who had to read 2 books each semester. And I think that is something that gripes me till the end of day. Because, yes.
Sorry, is your criticism that it forced us to read
too much?
16 books a year.
Right, but that's not all we had to do.
No, yeah.
You know, like.
Yeah.
If you think about that workload for the rest of our classes as well, so that's, like, 16 just, like, information things that we have to take out, times that by, let's do this, shall we? Let's do the damn math, shall we? Yeah. 1 moment. How many classes do we have? How many less?
6.
6. 16 times 6. Clearly, I didn't do very well at math.
Didn't we both do the dumb math?
Yeah, we did the dumb math, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Is 96, like, pieces of information, 96 projects, essentially, that we had to do a year. That's too many for a 16-year-old, I've decided. I know in hindsight it doesn't seem like that much, but as a 16-year-old who used to be 15, think about it in that, you know? Like, you are still going through your adolescence, you are still going through all the hormonal changes, and then you're, like, also expected to essentially be an adult. that's not fair. I hated when like teachers used to be like, oh, you need to be like act like an adult. Like, how would you be in the real world? I'm not an adult yet. I shouldn't have to act like this yet.
I so hear you. Yeah, I do hear you. Totally. I do also completely disagree with you.
Totally. Tell me.
Like, I think what's interesting is the way that like the idea of adolescence and like being a teenager is socially constructed, right? Like, yes, the Industrial Revolution was not a great time for people, but at the time there was no concept of like teenagehood and adolescence. And so, you know, you'd like turn 13 and just like become an adult that much faster. And the expectations of adulthood would all come with that. You know, and I'm not saying that's the solution. And that is the only example that I'm providing right now, but that's not what I'm advocating for. But I think the way that we've conceptualized adolescence and teenagehood infantilizes people to an extent.
I agree with you to a certain extent, but like your hormones do be hormoning. Like during like
totally
those ages, and like if you're gonna like use that rhetoric, then I think it's a little harmful, because then like kids who have to like raise themselves, you know what I mean? But it, like, it doesn't matter because they're like teenagers also, and that's, it's not actually a thing, you know? But at the end of the day, we do live in the society that we've helped construct, so therefore we participate in it, and therefore we have to deal with like, you know, the structures around it, I guess. But I don't know, I'm reading, I was like in the, we cut off a few seconds ago, but then we've back in that time I was reading like the Reddit sub thread of like ID trauma, and one of the Redditors was like, I am in my third year of my undergrad degree and I am still like traumatized from like IB. And then I read another one and it was like, oh, I'm in my second PhD and IB was still the hardest time of my academic career. And I would agree, it really was the hardest time of my academic career. Yeah, I think I understand that like you went into it being, oh, you know, like it was a very exciting thing to like learn. And it is like a great concept. Like it's a great, like, you know, way and like theory and like what it's like trying to get us to do. That is great in terms of like learning. But I think it also like makes this girl like quite competitive as well, because like our teachers really expect like the most from us. And it's like we're letting them down. And I don't know. I felt like it wasn't a very, like, it didn't really inspire a community, or it didn't inspire, like, group, you know, like, let's do this all together. And I used to see the OP kids and it felt like that, you know? So, I don't know. That sounds, like, so sad and dramatic, but.
But I wonder if the reason we didn't feel that sense of community is because of the curriculum, or because of the fact that it was a choice and the people choosing it were people who wanted that highly competitive advantage later, you know?
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Why did you choose it?
I think if the cohort was filled with, why did I?
Yeah.
I wanted to finish what I started, right. You know?
Yeah.
Like, not much had been consistent over my schooling from, because, you know, I went to like 5 to 6 different schools, yeah. I can't remember. But the one thing that was consistent was that I had done IB and I wanted to finish that.
Right, yeah, that's fair.
I also, you know, I love the rhetoric around it, of it being like, you know, global and like well-rounded. Like, I liked that. It made me happy. And I wanted to be the person that IB suggested I could become. And I think I did. So
there you are. No, totally. Yeah, I get
why did you choose it?
The rhetoric as well. I like the fact that it was like a well-rounded thing. I like that I had to do like multiple different things. I really liked the concept of theory of knowledge. I think that really like drew me into it. I really wanted to do that subject. My brother also started IB and then dropped out, and so I wanted to be better than him. And I was, sorry. And I am, sorry. I did get what I set out to get in that sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think we obviously had like a unique experience like doing IB in the way that we did, in the sense that it was a choice. But I think going into these like Reddit threads and like hearing from other IB kids, it's very much the same sentiment of like, it really was a very competitive environment. And I also think that has to do with the certain amount of privilege that comes with doing the IB curriculum, because it's mostly like in international schools and, you know, in like higher socioeconomic areas where like, and, you know, richer schools that were doing the IB, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the tea, I guess. Okay, quick fire. What are two things that you loved about the IB and like what it's done for you, and two things that you hated?
I loved that it gave me space to pursue my own interests. Mm-hmm. So like the personal project at the end of year 10 and the extended essay, both of them, I just did projects hyperfixating on the Olympics, which would not fit into any other unit, but like, let me learn about my own interests. And I feel like as an artist, that's a really important skill to be able to do, which is honor what you want and are curious by. Mm-hmm. And I feel like IB supported that. So that's one. Two things? You want two things?
Let's just do one. That was the long one.
Right, there's one.
Okay, and one thing that you hated?
I was about to say, I really hated how it was exactly the same globally, like down to the exams and the curriculums and everything. But I enjoyed that because I actually, you know, could find study resources. Like finding study resources shaped perfectly to the exam you would do was so easy because everyone was in the same boat globally. But I guess I think there is a certain level of like homogeneity that is taught by it, because it's so like the curriculum is handed down for the people in Switzerland, that maybe it doesn't give enough affordances to local culture and knowledge.
True. Very true. That's very counterintuitive, though.
How about you? I know.
Yeah. So everything you just said was wrong. But the thing that I liked about it was, yeah, definitely that critical thinking was really ingrained into us.
Yeah.
Like every single thing we had to do, we had to like know like the source, like where we got it from, like who said the source, and like their context in like the whole situation. And I really enjoy that. And I've like carried that through my life. I really also enjoyed the fact that my theory of knowledge project, my talk project, the presentation that we had to make was about cultural appropriation. And I got to like call out just like one class member, like indirectly about culturally appropriating something.
Wait, who?
It was, okay, this is bleeped, but like, I just wanted to call him out.
Well.
Yeah, and so that was really lovely. So from a personal vendetta point of view, Ivy was great for that. And the one thing that I hated about it, was that
workload, surely.
Yeah, the workload, because I already said that, so I want a new one.
Well, I prepared a rebuttal to a workload, so.
Do you want me to say that?
I want you to say rebuttal.
Okay.
Workload.
Yeah. I think one thing that I hated about it was definitely the workload. I was tired all the time. I think I'm still tired from then. I got no sleep, and neither did any of my classmates. So now with a growing girl. Ryan said he has a rebuttal to this. What is it? If you say I'm weak, I literally will come over there.
You did it though. Like you achieved it. You did the work.
Totally.
And
yeah,
I think it proves that you can do it. And
if you wonder, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
I wonder to what extent. To what extent did it feel like so much because we were studying it as like a marginalized course within a broader context, and there was such rhetoric and a story surrounding it that it was ultra hard and difficult. Like, I wonder if it would have felt easier if we hadn't been told how hard it was so much.
Right. I disagree, because I didn't realize how hard it was till my first year of uni when I was like, fuck, this is really easy.
What but isn't that a good thing? Doing? Isn't that a good thing?
No, because I think it could have been the same as like undergrad. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but you know, like it meant that by the time I got to first year of uni, I was like, oh, this course, that's fucking easy. Let me go do 80 different extracurriculars.
It also meant that I was so over academia that I didn't try uni.
Oh, neither. Neither.
Yeah.
Neither. I put in work into my degree.
Yeah, yeah. Because I was so burnt out.
Would you have done it again if you had the chance?
Yeah, yeah. And I'll definitely be making my kids do it. But like...
Because profoundly same. I'm like, literally any child who I have control over will be doing IB. No,
absolutely. And it's like, I want them to have the same character development as me. And so in order for them to be funny, they have to do IB. So... Okay, speaking of depression, what's your go-to depression meal?
I really love ordering in, like, spending $60 on Indian takeout and then surviving off that for 3 days.
Wow! So your go-to depression meal is to give back to my community. Mine is tuna pasta, which is so...
Oh, so appropriating my culture.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's reparations, actually. So,
of course.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's tuna pasta with a shit ton of cheese, and then I also shit myself after, and it's like a nice, like, circle of life moment, you know? I feel cleansed.
But the idea of fish and cheese, I don't know.
No, totally. It is a depression meal. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a rating and tell a friend.